We are on the last line of the Afya Dalet Amud Beis, and we're finishing up the sugya with Kriya Shema and Tfilin. And now we're going to move our focus a little bit to Netilas Yadayim, a practice that I think most of us, and truth is, it's not just us. The Gemara has any number of situations that require Netilas Yadayim in general for keeping one's hands clean. And once upon a time, they made brachos more frequently. I think if you look at the halachic literature over time, slowly but surely, Netilas Yadayim starts to lose its bracha, with the exception of two situations where we still all make a bracha. Number one is what we'd say when you wash Nagel Vasser when you get up in the morning, the first time, and whenever you're washing for bread. But everything else, we don't wash our hands for. Now, when you go back to the Gemara, and certainly even the early Rishonim, they're still washing their hands with Netilas Yadayim after going to the bathroom, even in a situation that will come up at Seder night, which I think is sort of not so well known. But when you do Tibul of the Karpas, so we don't make a bracha. But the Torah thinks you do make a bracha, and many of the Rishonim think that you make a bracha. Because in the time of Chazal, whenever you ate something that was tibula b'mashke, whenever you dip something in a liquid, because liquids are sort of a major conveyor of tuma, whatever reasons in the laws of tuma v'tara, liquids are a conduit for tuma. Therefore, the Chachamim decree that if you were going to dip a food, and assuming you're holding it with your hand, you dip a food in a liquid. Then you require Netilas Yadayim before. So when we do that for Karpas, that's actually what we're still doing. I know personally, if I wash fruit off and I don't dry it, so following the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch, I wash my hands. I don't make a bracha. I think the Vilna Gaon may have made a bracha. But if you dry it off, it doesn't require a bracha. Minhag, I think, of a large part of Klal Yisrael is not to wash either. But we don't, so we don't make the bracha anymore. But Rishonim made the bracha on that. So, one of the things that also requires Netilas Yadayim would be tefillah. Now, I think part of the reason we are particularly, I think, less makbid on this, or many of us less makbid, is because we live in much cleaner environments. For the most part, our hands aren't so dirty. You know, there's a minhag to wash mayim achronim. Already in Ashkenaz, they're not washing. Now, ostensible reason they're not washing mayim achronim is because the Gemara says that you wash mayim achronim because of melach sedomis. There's a certain kind of salt that it could be actually dangerous if you got it in your eyes. So after you finished eating your meal, then you would wash mayim achronim. So the Balei Tosfos say we don't wash mayim achronim because we don't have this melach sedomis. But there is a halacha that even if you're not concerned about mayim achronim per se, nonetheless, if your hands are dirty or oily, you're not supposed to bench until you clean them. It's not covered for the bracha. Now, I think today, not that that never happened, but we eat with utensils. They didn't always eat with utensils. A spoon was standard fare because you can't. It's kind of hard to eat soup, or drink a liquid without a cup or a spoon. But if you're talking about the rest of their food, they ate with their hands. A knife was used to cut things into small things that you could bite and so on. But their hands were very dirty eating in a suit, though you could understand why there would be a concern about washing one's hands for the bracha. Today, for most of us, we eat with a fork and a knife and a spoon, and we've got a napkin with us too. Our hands are often not really dirty at the end of the meal. So we are less, I think, less makbid than typically was when it comes to Netilas Yadayim in general. And for the most part, we do it first thing in the morning with a bracha before we bench. That's certainly where it's standard with a bracha. Some people are very concerned if they touch their shoes. I don't know if everybody's so mocked, but we live in, again, much, it used to be their shoes were filthy. Don't walk around, in the woods, and in sandy and dirty in areas that are not paved, and you'll see your shoes get very dirty. We live in an environment that's, hygienically speaking, very, very, very different. So anyway, but there is some idea also of washing one's hands for tefillah, which goes beyond just dirty hands. It seems to be a kind of preparation for tefillah. So the Gemara on the bottom of Daf Yadalma Beis, the last line, and we had already seen a little bit in Rav, in the description of what Rav did, the Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Harotze Sheyakabal Alav Omach Hoshamayim Shlema. If a person wants to accept upon him or herself Omach Hoshamayim in its fullest manifestation, He should do the following. Yifne, person should first go to the bathroom. That would typically have been done in the morning. V'yito yada, then one should wash one's hands. V'yoniach tefillin, then one should put on tefillin. And then v'yikra kriyashma v'yispala. Then say kriyashma. And David, v'zohi malchus shamayim shlema. And the focus presumably really is on the kriyashma, less on the tefillah, but that's just part of the Seder Hayom. I think Rabbeinu Yonah, the Tamidi Rabbeinu Yonah here on the Rif, quotes Rabbeinu Yonah's explanation. Why is this o malchus shamayim shlema? So Rabbeinu Yonah says that the focus really is not on the going to the bathroom and washing one's hands, but rather on the tefillin. And the reason why tefillin are necessary for Kabbalas O Malchus Shamayim Shlema, so Rabbeinu Yonah says that when a person puts on the tefillin Shibarosh, so one makes his soul and his mind subservient to God. And then one puts on the tefillin shel yad, and one is mishabed the rest of the body, the guf. And then he mentions, if you have a mezuzah as well, although we don't, obviously we don't, the mezuzah is not mentioned here because this is not the time of mezuzah. But basically, once you've surrounded yourself with the signs that indicate that you're making yourself subservient to God, now you're ready to say, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says. Okay. And then the Gemara continues, Amar Rav Chiya Rabba, Amar Rav Yochanan, Kol Nifne, V'notel Yadav, U'meniach Tfilin, V'kore Kriyashma, U'mispalel. So the person who does this, and who is what we might say, Mekabel Ol Mahashamayim Shlema, so Male Alav HaKosov, Ki'ilu Bona Mizbeach, V'hikrev Alav Karbon. It's as if he built a Mizbeach and brought a carbon upon it. And presumably what this means is the right mizbeach. You know, the Gemara has an expression that one who takes a vow, we don't like nedarim. We don't like people taking vows. And we, after you take a vow, we don't like people trying to fulfill them. We prefer that you go and do hataras nedarim. So the Gemara says that kol anoder ki'ilu bana bama. Anyone who takes a vow is as if they had built an altar, a bama. And chalamakaima, anyone who fulfills the vow instead of seeking heter is ki'ilu hikravala, as if he brought a karban on there. But a bama is something that is no longer permitted. Once upon a time, there were certain periods in Jewish history where you could build, you know, everybody could have their shul in their backyard, so everybody could have a mizbeach in their backyard. You built a bama. Once you have Mishkan Shiloh, and after, even though Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed, once the Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, during those two time periods, during Mishkan Shiloh and once the first Beis HaMikdash was built, there's no longer any permission to bring on your own private mizbeach. Any karbonos have to be brought in the Mikdash. So here, when it says ki'ilu bana mizbeach v'hikrev alav karbon, presumably it means you built the Beis HaMikdash, the mizbeach and the Beis HaMikdash, because generally we don't regard building a mizbeach as your own mizbeach as a good thing. And how do they know that? Dichsiv erchatz b'ni kayon kapai. Now, the second half of the verse says, I have gone around your Mizbeach. What is the first half? Erchatz b'ni kayon kapai. And the simple reading of this is, I wash my palms, erchatz kapai, b'ni kayon, with something that cleans them. So this statement seems to be focusing not on the not just per se on the Kriyashma, but actually on the Netilas Yadayim. There's the person apparently who prepares for being Mekaba Omach Shemayim by cleaning, by being properly prepared, by cleaning his hands, right? He's ready for this new job. So that's as if he built the Mizbeach. That's as if he went around God's Mizbeach. Erchatz b'ni kayon kapai. So now, in response to that statement, which Chiya Bar Abba quoted, Amar le Rava, Rava said to Chiya Bar Abba, you made it sound like it's only about building Mizbeach. Isn't it more? Lo Savar Lamar Ki'ilu Taval, Dichsiv Erchatz B'ni Kayon, V'lo Kisiv Architz Kapai. So apparently, Rava, I'm not really sure what the significance of this is, but it sounds like Rava saying that when you wash your hands for Netilas Yadayim for Tefillah, it's not only like you just washed your hands; it's like you went to the mikveh. Okay, I'm not sure why that is so incredibly significant, because it doesn't say Architz Kapai. It doesn't say I will wash my hands, or cause my hands to be washed. It says erchatz, I will bathe. It uses lashon kal, intransitive, as opposed to, even though that's not the way we use it, as opposed to architz, which would imply that you cause something else to be washed. So apparently erchatz, the way Rava reads it, again, I think we I guess it is correct, actually. Berachatzu aron avim yavimenu. No, it isn't true. The binyan kal takes the object. Berachatzu es yudehem es raglehem. So anyway, but Rava decided anyway that this should have had a hifil, should have had a more transitive sense. So apparently it is erchatz benikayon. I am bathing myself cleanly. I'm not sure how he reads the word exactly, kapai, in this context. But okay, so Rava says when you wash your hands for in preparation for tefillah, for kriyas shma and tefillah, it's like you went to the mikveh. Okay, don't tell that to the Hasidim. The Hasidim still like to go to the mikveh. But the rest of us will suffice with the Tilas Yadayim.
Really, we do?
Yes.
Why didn't they use the pasuk that you just quoted from Kisisa?
Why didn't they use
it
that?
Used the, more relevant, yeah, from the Kiyar.
Well, firstly, that's a mitzvah to the Kohanim to do Kiddush Yadayim Veraglayim in a Kiyar. Here, what Rabbi Yochanan is darshaning the verse in Tehillim he's reading. This is a personal, an act of personal virtue. Erchatz bani ker kapai. When I wash my hands, right? It's not a mitzvah. When I wash my hands, it's like vasovavas misbachach Hashem. It's like I go around the altar. But the mitzvah in Kisisa, that's a specific command to the Kohanim.
Kapai here, can this also include my palms of my hand and the soles of my feet in this erchatz?
Interesting question. I think that's not how the Gemara is taking it, but you do have the expression kafregel. So the pshat problem, I don't know. I'm not sure what the pshat is. You're suggesting, I see two of you are suggesting that maybe, except for David, it's not a Kohen, but this is almost like what the Kohanim would be doing, right?
Right. We say Nitilat Kapayim, we talk about our hands.
Nisiyot Kapayim.
Nisiyot Kapayim, we say hands. And Kapai seems like more global. So hands and feet, okay.
So it's an interesting question, you know, whether or not this cup, we know whether this is almost like a veiled reference to Kiddush Yadayim Veraglayim, to go around the Mizbeach. But the Gemara here, or Rabbi Yochanan here, is not taking it that way. He's taking it as an act of individual worship and piety. And so he says that, as Rabbi says, when you wash your hands in preparation for Kriyas Shma Tefillah, it's like you've gone to the mikveh. Okay. Amar Le Ravina La Rava. So Ravina says to Rava, Chazimar Haitzurva Mirabonan Da Asa Miram Rava. Have you seen this young Talmud Chacham who's come from the West, come from Eretz Yisrael? And he said, "V'omar misha ein lo mayim lirchot yada mekaneach yada v'afar uvitzvar uvikismis." If someone doesn't have water, they don't have access to water, so they should rub their hands in the dirt or in pebbles or kismis would probably be like wood chips. The purpose, I know it seems counterintuitive, rubbing your hands in the dirt to get them clean, but it's actually perfectly intuitive. I mean, your hands may be dirty in one sense, but if you're looking to get oily stuff off or any other kinds of junk that's attached to your hands, so anything that will, I guess, generate enough friction, it will help clean off your hands. So this Talmud Chacham apparently said that if you don't have water, you use some other type of cleaning, anything that will clean off your hands. So Amar Le Rava said to Ravina, Shapir Kamar, he's correct. Michziv erchatz b'mayim. It doesn't say erchatz b'mayim kapai. I'll wash my hands with water. It says erchatz b'nikayon. B'nikayon ksiv. And nikayon means kol midei d'menake. Anything that cleans. And now he links it to the following statement. Deha Rav Chista layit aman d'mahader amaya. Rav Chista used to curse out somebody who would go running after water. Now, what exactly? Now, I purposely paused here because some of the Rishonim claim the Gemara doesn't say anything further than this, or maybe Be'idan Slusa, maybe Be'idan Kriyashma. It's not clear what exactly the Girsa is here. But apparently, Rav Chista did not approve of somebody when it came to either Zman Kriyashma, Zman Tefillah, and it was time to read it. He's going to be a frumi. He's going to be running after water. if Zman Kriya Shema is here, it's time to, you know, get going and do what you need to do and not be running after water. So the way it reads in our Gemara is Rav Chista Lai Amanda Mahadar Amaya Beidon Slusa. Someone who'll be running after water once the Zman Tefillah came. Instead, clean your hands or whatever you can clean it. If you find some dirt on the ground, rub it. If you find a towel, just rub it off. Forget about running for water because you might miss Zman Kriya Shema Zman Tefillah. So that's what the Gemara says. Rav Chista would curse someone who would be running after water of Idan Slusa. This expression, by the way, is not an uncommon one. When you have one of the Amoraim would be Layat, which means literally in Aramaic to curse someone who would do X. It's almost like a statement of a little bit less than usser, but strongly, strongly disapproving. So then the Gemara says, and these are the controversial words, Vahani mila l'kriyashma, ava l'tfila mehader. When we say that once the Zman has reached, you're not supposed to be running after water, that's only for Kriya Shema. But for Tefillah, which does require, we assume Tefillah has greater requirements in general than Kriya Shema. Despite the fact that Kriya Shema is the Reisa, we have many more things that we require for Tefillah. Probably because Kriya Shema, you're reviewing the king's decree, but Tefillah, you're talking to God. When you're talking to God, so that you're really omed lefnei Hashem, you have to be behaving appropriately, you have to be dressed appropriately, you have to be cleaned appropriately. So it's one thing to be chasing after water for Kriya Shema, that's maybe not such, that's not so important. But for Tefillah, so that the Gemara, at least the way our Gemara reads, this is not what Tosfos has, for Tefillah, so you should be. Not necessarily if you're going to miss Zman Tefillah, but that's what you should be doing. And the Gemara then asked the question, Bad Kama, how far do you have to go in order to get water for Tefillah? Right, Zman Tefillah's here, and I want a daven, but you tell me I don't have water. So how long, how much time do I have to, or how much time can I dedicate to that? So the Gemara says that up until a parset, and the way it's formulated here, if this Gemara exists at all, again, Tosfos claims this Gemara doesn't exist. But if the way it's formulated here, ad parsa, is really borrowing from a Gemara in Pesachim. And the Gemara in Pesachim says that there are three things for which if you need them, you should go up to four milen, four Roman miles, which is a farsang, which is a parsa. And beyond that, you don't have to go. But those cases are all where I'm traveling. I'm on the way. And let's say I'm on I-80 and I want to, let's say, eat. One of the examples from the Gemara Pesachim is Netila. I'm very hungry. I'm traveling I-80. I want to eat lunch. So the question is how long, and I don't have water with me. So the question is how far do I have to travel in order to get water? So the Gemara there says that a mil, that a parsa, a 4 mil, that if there's a rest stop within 4 mil, and I don't know if that's a pure time calculation, or which would be about 72 minutes, or that's a distance calculation. Today, obviously, we can travel 4 mil much faster than they could travel 4 mil. A Roman mile is about like 4,800 something feet, so it's not that much less than our mile. So the Gemara there says that if there will be water within 4 mil of where you are, and you're going in that direction anyway, so wait till you get to the, assuming you know, obviously, that till you get to the water source. If it's more than 4 mil, then you don't have to wait. That's looking forward. What about if there's water, you just passed the rest stop where there was water? So the Gemara says that the honeymili likame, that's only if it's on your way. So it's, you're not going out of your way, you just have to wait a little bit longer. Avola chore, if it's going backwards, let's say you passed the rest stop, afilu mil eno chozer, you don't even have to return 1 mile. Now, if I had read this Gemara, I would have just said, it means you don't have to return at all. But the Gemara takes it in a sense very literally, umine. And what you would infer from that is, milhu de eno chozerhu, papachos mi mil chozer. So you, in other words, if the rest stop is less than a mile behind you, then you have to turn around, even if you're going out of your way, and go back to get the water if you want to eat without netilas adayim. If it's more than a mile behind you, no need to go back. What about in front of you? So the Gemara here says 4 miles. So the implication, as if this Gemara is correct, if this text really exists, which, as I said, Tosfos claims it doesn't, so then you have to wait for Netilas Yadayim. You have to actually make an extra effort, go out of your way for Netilas Yadayim up to 4 mil. Now, Rashi and Tosfos don't agree with this. And Rashi in Psachim quotes a different interpretation of the expression. The Gemara says that there are three things for which the shear is these 4 miles that you have to go for. One of them is gabal, one of them is netila, and one of them is tevila. Tevila. So gabal, netila, and tevila. So a gabal, we're not going to talk about it. It has something to do with making sure that the dough that you're working on will remain tahor. And we're not worried about Tumah Vatara today, so that's not our issue. Netila is assumed to be netilas yadayim for, let's say, eating bread. What is tefila? So Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rif, I think, understand this tefila as the Gemara presents it here. They have such a girsa that the Gemara says that for tefila, you actually have to go after weight 4 mil in order to get water to wash the tefilas yadayim before you daven. And if necessary, go backwards 1 mil. And Rashi and Tosfos claim that no such thing. That from a logical perspective, Tosfos says, why is it that Rav Chisda cursed someone who used to be searching for water during Zman Kriya Shema? Presumably, the concern is you were going to miss the Zman. You're so busy looking, hunting up and down, and trying to get some water for Netilas Shadayim, you miss Kriya Shema. So Tosfos says the same thing is true about Tefillah. It's true you have a little more time, but at the end of the day, if it's Zman Tefillah, this comes. And you're busy, you know, worrying about finding water, you might end up missing Zman Tefillah. So they say that they don't have this whole part of the Gemara. They claim it's like from the Gaonim or something like that. And instead, Rashi in Psachim explains that the Arba Milan for Tefillah means the following. If you are traveling on the way and it's time to daven, and you want to daven, but you don't have a minyan where you are because most people don't carry a minyan in their backpack. So you have to wait till you find the minyan. Do you have to wait? So Rashi says, if there's a minyan, 4 milin in front of you, within 4 mil, where you'll be able to go there and be able to daven mitzibur, then you should wait to daven. Going backwards, you don't have to go more than a mil, but less than a mil, you would have to go out of your way in order to daven mitzibur. This is an interesting statement. I don't remember if I spoke about it in our shiur, if we explored the issue of the strict obligation of tefillah b'tzibur. My recollection is we did touch upon that topic at some point. And this is one source, and it's not the only sheet, but one source that suggests that tefillah b'tzibur may be obligatory. If you read the Shulchan Aruch, tefillah b'tzibur is highly, highly recommended, but it's not clear that it rises to the level of a technical obligation. One would not say that one has violated a ver for not davening b'tzibur on a particular occasion, but there does seem to be something of a range of opinion in Rishonim. It kind of, in the Shulchan Aruch, it kind of lives between highly recommended obligatory, but doesn't quite reach the latter. But Rashi here at least understands you can either see the Gemara as advisory or obligatory. It's not 100% clear, but that if you have a tzibur 4 miles further on your journey, so then you should wait to daven mitzibur until you get to that. Otherwise, you don't have to go back a mile or more. Okay, so that's the end of this sugya. And now the Mishnah is going to resume talking about reading Kriya Shema. The first Mishnah spoke about a little bit about in Kiveh Nibo, you have to have Kavanah Salev, whatever that means. And now the Mishnah had interrupted to talk about what were the various parshiyos of Shema, and now they go back to the mechanics actually of reading. And the reason why the Mishnah interrupted is because the Mishnah gave you the rules of interrupting during the middle of Kriya Shema. So it spoke about Baprakim and Ba'emtza, and once the Mishnah tells you Baprakim and Ba'emtza, it's going to talk about what the various segments that make up Kriya Shema, what's considered in between the segments, and so on. But now we return to issues that are very material to reading, specifically the act of reading Kriya Shema.
Rabbi, can I ask a quick question on the end of the last discussion, which seems very focused on hygiene rather than Tumah Vatara? How does that inform the need for a cup when you wash or kli? It would seem like, I mean, what's the relationship there?
So for sure, they would say that, I'm pretty sure the kli is secondary there. Like when it comes to Netilas Yadayim for what we call Srach Truma, for washing for food, so there's a need to use a cup.
But for the Nagel Vasser washing, I mean, is that what we're talking about, or is that Ruach Ra, and this is a separate washing? Which washing are we talking about here?
This is not Ruach Ra. It's right. not ruach ra, and it's not the washing of bread of tumah, you know, concern of srach okay. tumah. This is really cleanliness. If I'm not mistaken, even the ruach ra, it's not clear how important the kli is there. The context in which the kli and the main discussions on the tila sedayim are found in the in Perikol Abasar, and that's where the obligation, you know, that's washing for, that's really washing for bread, and that's where the Gemara talks about what they call the natla, the kli that they used to wash with. But I don't remember, you know, as I think they recommend the kli, let's say for Nagel Vas in the morning, but I don't remember if it's strictly, I don't think it's required on the same level as it is for Netilas Sedayim for bread. Okay. Before we go on, actually, I also want
to read it. Was the kli used at with the kiyor? Was a cup used with the kiyor? Or did it come directly out of the spout?
Did it? I think it came. I don't know. I don't want to answer that question. I have to get you an answer for next week on that one. People had asked the question last week. I had a chance to look in Shulchan Aruch about taking off your talis, taking, do you make another bracha, taking off your tefillin. So there is basically a machlokas, the Mechaber and Ramah. The Mechaber says that whenever you take off your talis or your tefillin, for whatever the reason, you have to make another bracha when you put it back on. The Ramah disagrees in both places. The Ramah says that if you took it off intentionally with the intention of putting it back on, miyad, I don't know how to define how immediately is immediate, but very soon. So then the Ramah offers a compromise. He says, if you take off your big talis, if you're still wearing your talis katan, then you don't make another bracha. However, the way the Mishnah Berurah explains this, it's not really about a talis katan. It's all about what we call hesei chadas. What is your intent? And I don't know why, but the assumption is somehow if you're still wearing your talis katan, then you plan to put your talis katan back on. But it is clear that regardless, if your intent is clear when you take it off to put it back on, so the Ramah says that you wouldn't. Now he says miyad, which means soon. He said you wouldn't make another bracha. However, so some achronim would say that if you go to the bathroom, if you take a shower, you go to the merchatz. So then they say that's not miyad and you have to make another bracha. But it sounds from the Mishnah Berurah in the Bir HaLacha that he's not convinced, that a lot are not convinced of that. So I don't think I would tell somebody, if you take your talis off, whether it's to go to the bathroom or you take your tzitzis off and knowing you're going to put it back on later, I think the minhag is not to make another bracha on it. When it comes to tefillin, if you take the tefillin off intentionally, for whatever the reason, with the intent to put it back on shortly, you would not, according to the Ramah, you would not make another bracha. But if you go to the bathroom, you have to make another bracha since you cannot wear the tefillin in the bathroom, as opposed to the talis, which even though men normally take off their talis gadol when they go to the bathroom, it's not technically, you're not technically obligated to do so. Whereas tefillin, you're not allowed to wear in the bathroom because the tefillin actually have kedusha. And therefore, if you had to go to the bathroom between, you have to make new brachas when you put your tefillin back on. So in reality, it's very hard to imagine a scenario where somebody takes their tefillin off and he's not going to make a bracha when they put them back on. It's not impossible, but it's not a typical scenario. Whereas the talis, I would tell you, if you go to the bathroom, take a break in the middle of shul, so then you would not make, if you took it off knowing well that you're going to make another bracha, you don't make another, knowing you're going to put it back on, you don't make another bracha. Okay. So anyway, so that was for last week. But Sam, I have to get an answer to that question, which is, did they wash with a kli? Or directly out of the spigot?
Netilas yadayim and not chitzas yadayim.
Right. But they see one thing. There is one source that suggests that they used to wash it directly out of the kiyar, although it's not 100% clear. The Mishnah in Yoma speaks of a number of very nice donations that were made to the Beis HaMikdash. Some of them were aesthetic and some of them were pragmatic. And amongst the pragmatic ones was, I think, Ben Katin, I think gave a special kiyar, which had 13 spigots. I think it was 13. So all the Kohanim who were needed to wash their hands for the Avodah, for the Tamid Shel Shachar, there was, I think, 13 Kohanim needed, so they could all do it at once. They wouldn't have to be aligned. Now that sound, again, it could be, even if it's a single faucet, each person's got to fill their kli, so it's a long line. But I have a suspicion they washed it directly from the kiyar, not necessarily in the kiyar, but directly from the spigots coming out. But I'll have to find that out.
I mean, nusach habracha for us, why do we say netilas yadayim and not rechitzas yadayim?
Well, the better question is, what does netilas yadayim mean?
Okay.
Taking your hands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, what does that mean? I have this recollection. Maybe Rabbi Lookstein would have heard of such a thing. Some suggested, I'm skeptical, but that that it's related to the kli that was used, which is called a natla, nun tes lamed aleph. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense, because I think that there are earlier there are sources, I think, in the Mishnah, which use the term notla miyadayim, and that's not going to be influenced by, you know, the Aramaic kli, which is likely Babylonian Aramaic word. So I if I knew what natla shadayim meant, I might be able to answer that question, but I don't.
Is that the subject of our Gemara here? Meaning the Yifne v'Yitol Yadav v'Yaniach Tefillin, that's talking about the bracha al Natilat Shadayim we make in the morning, right?
Yes and no. In all probability, yes. But they're not talking about because of Ruach Ra. They're talking about probably either because of using the bathroom or as preparation to Tefillah or both.
But I never thought about that bracha as being a bracha on hygiene. I thought about it being a bracha on Ruach Ra, meaning on the Netilas Yadayim of eliminating Ruach Ra. But you're saying that bracha that you're making doesn't need a kli. You wake up, you use the bathroom, and you wash your hands in the sink with soap and water, and you make Al Netilas Yadayim on that bracha, on that act?
I don't want to answer that question without pulling the Shulchan Aruch off the shelf from in front of me. And I'll have to, you know, we normally use a kli. Would you make a bracha if you didn't have a kli? I don't want to say until I've checked. So I have a second question I have to answer. I think we usually assume that first, that netilah goes both for Ruach Ra and for tefillah, because you know you're going to be davening. But I have to get back with that to answer that question. Okay. So now the Mishnah turns its attention to how to read Kriya Shema properly. And amongst the things that you have to do when you read Kriya Shema properly is you have to read it properly. Now, properly might be how you pronounce the words. And there are a lot of interesting, I'm not going to talk about them now. I'll wait till we get to the Gemara and Tesof and Beis to talk about all the interesting kinds of errors people make in Kriya Shema. But in the meantime, let's just say that you have to be, the Mishnah says, medakdek ba'osiosah. You have to be careful in its letters and how you read it. The other question, which is the first issue the Mishnah addresses, is does it have to be audible? Which is always an interesting challenge, because reading something out loud generally means that you read it more carefully and you read it better. Of course, it may run up against disturbing your neighbor, which is always an issue. We say when it comes to tefillah that you have to be mispala balachash when you're in betzibur, because it's disturb other people's davening. The only exception to that is yamim no raim. But certainly for reading Kriya Shema, there is no such restriction. And quite to the contrary, there seems to be an idea of reading Kriya Shema enough that you can hear. So the Mishnah says, "Akore Yeshema v'lo hishmi ala osno yatsa." The simple reading of the Mishnah is you read Shema, which means presumably you mouth the words, but you don't. It's not audible. No sound is coming out. So when I'm saying Shema, instead of saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu, if you can hear that, I don't know if you can hear the whisper through that. Instead, I just mouth the words. And that is not considered. So the Mishnah says you're Yotze. And it's very clear. It doesn't mean it's belayed. It doesn't mean you're thinking the words of Kriya Shema. It means you are verbalizing them. But the question is, are you providing any voice where it's audible, at least to your ears? So the Tanakhama says, Kore Shema, v'lo hishmi ala osno yatsa. If you read Shema and you didn't make it audible to your own ear, you fulfilled your obligation. The simple reading of the Mishnah, and the Gemara is going to discuss this at length, is that this is only post facto. This is b'di'evit. In other words, if you read Kriya Shema that way, yatsa. It doesn't mean that's the way you're supposed to do it, but it just means as the most minimal standard, you fulfilled your obligation. Rabbi Yose Omer lo yatsa. Rabbi Yose says, if you read Kriya Shema and you can't hear the words, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Now, you would say that that's not called Kriya. You know, we talk about, I'm reading a book. Most of us, when we read a book, reading a book is a sort of a mental action, a visual action. But when we talk about the Torah reading, we don't, you know, the Shliach Tzibur, the Baal Kriya, doesn't get up there and, you know, scan the Torah with his eyes and he's reading it over. That's very nice, but we actually have to hear it. And in order to constitute Kriya in general, even if you were, let's say, reading the Megillah privately, nobody would say that if I'm looking at the Megillah without reading, enunciating the words on some level, nobody would say you fulfill your obligation. So Rabbi Yossi says, if it wasn't audible to your own ears, you're not even Yotzei. Kara v'lo dittek b'osioseha. If you read it, but you weren't careful in its letters, the Gemara will talk about what that means. Rabbi Yose Omer Yotze, Rabbi Huda Omer La Yotze. Here the positions flip. Rabbi Yose, who said that it has to be audible, and if you don't make it audible, you don't fulfill your obligation, he says, presumably, you have to be careful with the letters and the words, but Rabbi Yose says you're Yotze even if you aren't. And Rabbi Yehuda, who's probably the Tanakam of the Mishnah, who said there that it kara v'lo hishmiya la'oznav, you're Yotze, Rabbi Yehuda says if you don't read, if you don't, whatever reading means, the words bediktuk, carefully, you're not Yotze your obligation. Then the Mishnah gives us two other pieces of information. Hakore lemafreya lo yotze. If you read the psukim out of order, you're not Yotze. And as we quoted from the Rashba, and the Rambam says this as well at the beginning of the parak, this only means if you read individual verses within a section, within a parsha, so then you don't fulfill your obligation. If I first read v'shinan tam levanecha, and then I read v'yohavta yis Hashem elokecha, I didn't fulfill my obligation. But if you read parshas tzitzis first, or parshas v'hayayim shemoa first, and then you read Shema, so that the Rashba and the Rambam say that you do fulfill your obligation. That's not covered in Kori Lemafreya. Kori Lemafreya, reading it out of order, only means within a section. And finally, Kara v'ta'a, Yachzor Lemakom Shata. If you read Kriya Shema and then you realize you made a mistake in one of the earlier verses, so you have to go back to that place, start reading from there and go forwards. The reason for that, that this halacha fundamentally follows from the immediately preceding one. Because if you didn't have to read all the verses in order, so even if it were a nice idea, if I made a mistake in one verse, so I don't have to, I go back and I correct that verse, but now I should just continue where I am. But since you have to read Kriya Shema in order, and I didn't fulfill my obligation when I read that verse because I made an error, so I have to go back there and then continue on forward so that, in fact, the verse would be in order. I don't think that such an obligation technically applies in Kriya Satora. I remember many, many years ago, I wasn't about Kriya, but I got an Aliyah, and it was Matos Masei. And I'm still shy. I don't like to correct so much. But the Baal Kriya read a particular word in early in Pashas Masei, and I wasn't sure where he put the accent. The word was Nachla, and the word is supposed to be Nachla, which means Linachal, not Nachla, which either means an inheritance or sickness, one of the two. And I wasn't sure, but I didn't want to say anything. And I just, you know, towards the end of the Kriya, I was talking, I asked, you know, about Kriya, which way he read. He wasn't sure. They decided they weren't going to send him back. Now, the truth is, they didn't really, if we were sure he had made a mistake, I didn't want to, perhaps I thought he really did make a mistake, but I really didn't want to have the guy go back and have to read another 100 psukim on Shabbos Matas Masei. But the truth is, I realized in retrospect, it wouldn't have been necessary to go back and read the entire parsha. You probably could have gone back, had one aliyah of three psukim, because for the purposes of Kriya Satora, we generally like to read in order. It's not entirely clear to me that firstly, you don't have to al pidin read the entire Torah during the course of the year. Our minhag is to complete the entire Torah. But the strict obligation of Kriya Satora on Shabbos is to have seven aliyahs and have each person read at least three psukim. So I'm not sure that there's an strict obligation that this thing has to have been read in order. But let's say you were dealing with Mikra Megillah. A week ago from Friday, you're reading the Megillah and someone realizes that you made a mistake in Perek Gimel and now you're in Perek Ches. He realized he's been reading that word wrong his entire life. So the halacha is he's got to correct that pasuk, but he's got to go back to the pasuk and read from that point forward. Because just like Kriya Shema, Megillah has a rule that you cannot be Kori Lemafreya. You cannot read out of order. And Megillah, there's no, we don't say each chapter is a separate thing. And if you read the chapters out of order, it's okay. Megillah is one long thing of 160, I think, eight psukim, and they have to be read in order. So when it comes to Kriya Shema, if you realize that you made a mistake earlier, you have to go back at least within that parsha and read from that point forward. Okay. So now the Gemara is going to explore the question of being able to hear your own, hearing what you're saying.
Rabbi.
Yes.
In the Mishnah, is it referring back immediately to an error reflecting the preceding phrase, or is it just saying in general, if you made a mistake, karavata'a, you know, he made a mistake, I don't know, he mixed up the letters in a word or something. What is it refer to?
So it refers to making a mistake, period. In other words, well, my observation is the following. Karavata'a, in the Mishnah, could have just said, you have to reread that pasuk with the correctly. But the Mishnah doesn't just say that. The Mishnah says, Yachsor lemakom shata. You have to go all the way back. And that is the fact that you can't just fix the pasuk. I misread Vishinan Tam Levanecha. So you know what? I already finished Kriyashma. I'll just say, I'll read the pasuk Vishinan Tam Levanecha correctly now. That would satisfy the need of reading the pasuk correctly. But now, you wouldn't have read your Kriya Shema in order. The only way to have read Kriya Shema in order is to go back to Vishinan Tam Levanecha and then read, continuing from that point forward. That's the point. Okay, so now the Gemara asks the following question. My time at the Rabbi Yosei. Why does Rabbi Yosei believe that you don't fulfill your obligation? Well, I would say twofold. How do you know that you have to hear yourself reading Kriya Shema? And how do you know that you don't fulfill the obligation? So my time at Rabbi Yosei, the Gemara says, Mishum dechsiv Shema Yisrael. Listen, Hashmeya la'oznecha ma'asha tamotzi mipicha. If you're being told that you, Shema, obviously the pshat means, listen, you know, hear, O Israel, does not refer to an act of audio perception. That's not what it refers to. Shema Yisrael means, you know, when you complain that your children don't listen to you, you're not suggesting that they have a hearing problem. Or as we once, with my older son, who is a wonderful young man, but when he was very, very young, we were concerned that he had a hearing problem. And we took him for an exam, and they did a hearing exam on him. And they said he had absolutely perfect hearing. And we figured out he had a hearing problem. He had a listening problem. But, you know, that's a common thing. Josh is laughing because Josh probably lives with this. So the bottom line is Shema Yisrael on the pshat level means, you know, hearken, pay attention. But Rabbi Yosei darshans it. He says this Shema is Hashmei la'ozda chamot shepicha. You actually have to hear it. You have to hear it being read. The Tana Kama, what does the Tana Kama do with, what do they do with the pasuk? What do they learn from Shema Yisrael? The Gemara says, b'chol lashon sh'ata shomea. In any language you understand. So the Tanakhama's usage of Shema doesn't have to refer to the act of audio perception, right? It can refer to, just means understanding, accepting. In order to do that, it's b'chol lashon tashomea. We would say in any language you understand, not any language you hear. So that's what Tanakhama learns from Shema. We actually saw that drasha was on the first page of the parak. What does Rabbi Yosei learn? Tarti Shema Mina. Rabbi Yosei says he learned both. Shema means both to hear and it means to understand. So Rabbi Yosei says from the same pasuk, from one verse, he learns both the obligation that you can hear it in any language that you understand and that you actually have to physically have to hear it. Okay.
Peter?
Yes, Sam.
What Rabbi Yosei learns is a chiyuv. You have to do it that way. But what the Tanakhama is saying is just the rishus. You may read it in other languages. So it's a little, maybe that's why Rabbi Yosi can learn both, because usually you can't learn two things from one word. But here it's one is a chiyuv and one is a rishus.
That's possible. But the alternative, I'm not sure that actually, your observation is a good observation. But nonetheless, these are two individual dinim. In other words, you're right. You don't have to listen to Kriya Shema if you're a Swahili speaker, you don't have to listen to Kriya Shema in Swahili. You can listen to it in Hebrew if you would like. But the fact that you can even listen to it in Swahili, so that you need a pasuk to teach you that. So once you need a pasuk to teach you that, so you're going to run into the same problem, right? You can't use one pasuk to teach you two laws. Because how do you know that the pasuk is available to teach you one if it has to teach you the other, right? If it's being, so I think what the Gemara means when it says tartish mamina means that one is implied by the other. Once you say b'chol lashon tash ashata shomea, in any language that you hear, So Rashi writes, Shema mina the tzorach nami lashmi lasto. And the truth is, I would have gone the opposite way. I would have said, Shema, you have to hear what you're saying. And the point to be able to hear what you're saying, there's no point in hearing in something you don't even understand what you're reading. So Rashi says it the other way. But I think it is clear that somehow, once you're interpreting one, it implies the other as well. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to collect all the sources that deal with the question of people not hearing what they're saying and whether you fulfill your obligation l'chatchila b'di'eved or not at all. So Tanan Hossam, the Mishnah in Trumos tells us the following halacha. Chemei shamedaber ve'eno shomea lo yitrom v'yem taram terumaso teruma. Okay, so this is Mishnah's interesting in a number of ways. The first one, so I have to make any of the grammarians very happy about this. What is the root of the word teruma? What's the root of that word?
Raise.
No, it's close.
Reishvavmem.
Reishvavmem. That's the root of teruma. You have a word like tenufa, to wave, that's nunvape. You have a word like tikuma. Not a bib. I don't. It might be biblical Hebrew. Kuf vav mem. That's the way you make a noun out of what we call ayin vav verbs. Verbs that whose middle root letter happens to be a vav. They call it hollow verbs. So tiruma, tiluna, tinufa, tikuma, and tishuva is shin vav beis. Okay. Now that was true in biblical Hebrew. In Mishnaic Hebrew, and this is an observation made by an esteemed personality of no lesser stature than the Rambam in his commentary, I believe, to this Mishnah. The Rambam says that even though biblical Hebrew, the word is resh vav mem, what happened in Mishnaic Hebrew is because the form tiruma is so common, is you got a new verb, which was tuf resh mem. And that's why you say, im taram tirumaso truma. If this were biblical Hebrew, it would have been v'im heirim tirumaso truma. So that's a new verb. Okay, so now, anybody who's going to be happy about the grammar, I was Yotze. So now let's talk about the substance of the Mishnah itself. A cheresh, someone who is deaf, halachically, we often have an expression, cheresh shota v'katan. Most of the time in Mishnaic literature, in rabbinic literature, when you have the expression cheresh shota v'katan, cheresh shedibru chachome b'chol makom eno shomea v'eno medaber. The cheresh that usually our sages speak of is the cheresh who is a deaf mute. In the time of Chazal, for the most part, without more advanced methods of education, someone who was a deaf mute was likely to be, we would say, developmentally disabled. They would never have picked up language, never picked up communication. That's the assumption that is being worked with here. Post can talk about it today, but I think that there's a general sense that this does not apply to someone who is a perfectly sound mind, but because of whatever issues cannot speak or cannot hear the way normally people do. We assume that cheresh, when we talk about cheresh shota v'katan, it means someone who is developmentally disabled, someone whose intellectual capacities are not, let's say, fully developed, appropriate for a particular age. Is someone who is, we would say, is suffering from mental illness. The shota could be someone, Rav Shechter always says, Shote can be super genius, but he walks around and he thinks he's Napoleon, right? So that could be someone who's very intelligent, very articulate. You could might even have a conversation with the person. The person is extremely articulate and interesting to talk to. And yet they're walking around, you know, believing, you know, living in an alternate universe. I mean, that's the way he describes it. The Gemara has descriptions that are not exactly the same, but they all boil down to this sort of the same thing. It's not someone who is what we would say, you know, who never fully developed intellectually, but someone who is grappling with some type of a mental health issue in a serious way. It doesn't mean someone who's depressed is a shota, but it's, you know, something where it crosses a certain extreme lines. So the Mishnah here, when it talks about a cheresh, it says, and the Mishnah is not talking about a cheresh shota v'katan who separate truma, because a cheresh shota and a katan can't separate truma because they're not considered of legal, legally sound mind. I understand there are many katanim who are very intelligent, but nonetheless, that's the halacha, that cheresh shota v'katan are not considered, at least for legal purposes, v'nei das. But the Mishnah here is not talking about a cheresh she'eno shomea v'eno medaber. It's talking about a cheresh hamedaber v'eno shomea. So they're calling him a cheresh. They would usually call him an elaim. He's someone who cannot speak. I'm sorry. No, I got that right. I'm sorry. He's not a mute. He cannot hear, even though he's able. He knows how to speak. He's medaber veino shomea. So, what's the problem? The problem. What do you do when you separate truma? Well, normally you would do the following things. I would take part of the grain. I would separate. I put it aside, and I would say this. I would say Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Me'acholam Asher Kidushanu Zasat Tzivanu Al Hafrashas Truma. On separating truma, and then I would say this grain here, this part is truma. Now, the Chemesh Hamedaber Veinu Shomea is able to do all of that, except for he can't hear himself making the bracha, nor can he hear himself actually if he designates it as truma. But a couple of important points need to be made. Number one, a bracha is only mid the Rabbanon in the context of truma. And therefore, if you don't make a bracha, the Hafrashas Truma, the designation of Truma, is still valid. That's very clear. And since the obligation of Bracha is only rabbinic, even if you have someone who's a mute who cannot make a Bracha, the Hafrashas Truma will still be good. Sometimes you have, like for example, a ceremony like Chalitza, where you're supposed to read the Psukim. And if you don't read the Psukim when you do the Chalitza, the brother-in-law reads some, the wife of the deceased reads some. If they don't read the psukim, as long as she takes off his shoe, the chalitza is valid. But if one of them is mute and cannot read the psukim, then the chalitza is invalid. In other words, this is a concept that comes up many places in Shas, that even details of a ceremony that are not absolutely necessary to fulfill the obligation, if one of the parties is not capable of doing it, then it does prevent the obligation from being valid. But that wouldn't apply here because the bracha on truma is only the Rabbanan. If someone's incapable of making the bracha, it doesn't matter. Furthermore, the Torah says, speaking about the truma that the Levi separates from the Maaser Rishon, the tenth of a tenth, the Maaser and Hamaser, the Torah says, v'nechshav lochem terumaschem. It will be considered for you your truma. In other words, I, the Yisrael, separate truma from all my grain for the Kohen. The Levi, after I give the Maaser Rishon to the Levi, he separates Truma from his Maaser. The Torah says, V'nechshav lochem terumaschem. And from that, Chazal learned that Truma is nitalas b'machshava. Like Superman, he can look with his eyes at something, and if he decides he wants this part of the pile to be Truma, now it's part of that is Truma. Even without articulating it, V'nechshav lochem terumaschem, it's nitalas b'machshava. So, The Gemara doesn't even seem to be concerned about that part because there is no obligation whatsoever. The only thing exists midrabanan to verbalize the fact that you're separating as truma. But there is an obligation midrabanan to make a bracha. So the Gemara now says, the Mishnah in Truma says that a deaf person who can speak but cannot hear, lo yitrom, he should not separate the truma, v'im taram truma so truma. He shouldn't do lachatchila, but if he does it, it's absolutely valid.
Rabbi Weider?
Yes.
Then who should do? Then how will the truma be separated?
He'll appoint a shaliach to do so. What? He'll appoint a shaliach.
Okay.
That's all. Chaimish, someone who's of sound mind can appoint a shaliach to do his things. So he'll ask someone else. He'll ask someone else, another family member. He'll designate, you separate the truma because you can hear the bracha. I can't hear my own bracha. So the Gemara now wants to know, Mantana that Cheresh Hamedaber v'Eino Shomea di Eved in l'chatchilala. Who is the Tana who believes that someone who is cannot hear his own bracha is not l'chatchila allowed to make the bracha, but post facto it's valid? Who is that? Who is the Tana? Now, the assumption of the Gemara right now, which it's about to perhaps modify, is that Rabbi Yehuda, the Tanakam of our Mishnah, who says, Akore Shema Valoshmil Esno Yotza, the Gemara for some reason is assuming that Yotza means even Lachatchila. And Rabbi Yose says, you're not even Yotza. So in other words, the two positions on the Mishnah are, Lachatchila, you don't need to hear what you're saying. Or, b'di'evit, if you don't hear what you're saying, you don't even fulfill your obligation. So we have a Mishnah in Truma that says, l'chatchila, you shouldn't do it. But b'di'evit, it's okay. So it kind of occupies that space in between. So the Gemara says, who is the Tana of that Mishnah? Amar Rav Chisda that the Eved in lechatchila lo that lechatchila a cheresh should not make the bracha because he can't hear his own bracha, but with the Eved it's good. Rav Chisda says Rabbi Yossi, it's Rabbi Yossi the Tanan Hakore Yishma. We're going to take out the words Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's not in the Mishnah, even though it probably is Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Rabbi Yosei Omer lo yatza. But Adkan lo kam Rabbi Yosei lo yatza. Elo legabe Kriya Shema d'oraisa. He only said it with respect to Kriya Shema d'oraisa, where we would should add that the mitzvah is reading it. Aval teruma mishem bracha ubracha d'rabbanan. Truma, the only reason why a Chevesh who speaks but can't hear isn't supposed to separate the Truma is because he can't hear the Bracha. The Bracha is the Rabbanon. And Veloba Bracha Talia Milsa. The issue, whether it's Truma or not, doesn't depend upon whether we make a Bracha or not. Truma depends upon whether or not you separate it. Therefore, Rabbi Yosei in that case says, look, ideally you're supposed to hear your own Bracha, but it doesn't prevent the Truma from being valid, from being binding. That's what Rav Chisda says. Now the Gemara asks, "Umi mai de Rabbi Yosei? Maybe how do you know that it has to be Rabbi Yosei? Dilma Rabbi Yehuda hi? Maybe the Mishnah and Trumos, the idea that a Cheresh cannot do it lichatchila because he can't hear his bracha. Maybe that's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. The Omar gabe kriyash manami di evedin lichatchila lo." And maybe Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, the assumption of the Gemara now is it's Rabbi Yehuda's the first Tan in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda believes that Kriya Shema, you're Yotzei, but you're not allowed lechatchila to read it that way if you're not gonna make it audible for yourself at least. So maybe Rabbi Yehuda says the Kriya Shema Nami di Eved in lechatchila lo and Teda, pay attention to the fact that Kotani, the Mishnah says Hakore Eshema v'lo Eshmi Eliyazno. Hakore is. It means if you dieved in lechatchila lo. That's typically what the use of the present tense of the participle means. Hakore eshma is yatsa means bidieved. That's not ideal. So the Gemara says maybe it is, in fact, Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. So the Gemara says, no. You know what? Don't make an inference from the fact that it says hakore. Why? Haide katan lo. Amri, they said, "Hai de katani hakore lo diach hakocho de Rabbi Yosei de Amar the Eved Nami lo." The reason why the Mishnah formulates it as hakore is because they want to give you. What should the Mishnah have said according to you? The Mishnah sort of said, "Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ein sarach lahashmiya la osno kishakore," and Rabbi Yosei says, "Sarach lahashmiya la osno." Had the Mishnah been formulated that way, then it's true, we would have understood that Rabbi Yehuda believes that you don't even need at all to make it audible. But with that formulation, Rabbi Yosei Omer, Tzarech Lashmiya, we would have said that Rabbi Yosei holds Lechatchila you're supposed to, but B'dieved, you would be Yotzei. So that's maybe why the Gemara says the Mishnah had to be formulated in the post facto tone, so you would understand that Rabbi Yosei clearly says Lo Yatza. Rabbi Yehuda says Hakore Shema, but he doesn't mean only b'di'evet. It's just because it has the two halves of the Mishnah normally literarily echo one another. So that's why they formulate it in the post facto formulation as opposed to what is required, what is ideal. But it could very well be the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda holds, you don't even need to do it lechatchila at all. And Rabbi Yosei says, you're not even Yotzei if you did it. Okay. So I'm going to stop here. We still have quite a bit to go. The Gemara is going to try to work through the rest of this to figure out in all the various areas of halacha where this comes up, in Birchas Hamazon and so on, who are the various players and what do they hold, and Mikra Megillah as well. And then the Gemara is going to repeat this all in a slightly different version on Tesvav Amud Beis, but we'll pick off at this point next week. Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.
Shukoach, thank you.